Good evening. Welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started this evening. Thank you for joining us. I hope you made it through the cold weather. Did the day get colder as the day went on? Oh my God. Thank God I keep a jacket in my car. I started layering again. So I appreciate you all being here. Welcome for folks who have never been to this before, and for those of you who have joined us for yet another journey to see the amazing work that's happening here in St. Petersburg. So this is the St. Petersburg Innovation District's 7th annual State of Science and Innovation. We're pleased to have so many of you who came in person, and to let you all know here in the room that we do also have a virtual audience. So we have quite a few people online joining us as well. If you have friends and family who missed today, we are also taping it. So we're just trying to get the word out about the cool work going on here. My name is Allison Barlow, and I am the Executive Director of the St. Petersburg Innovation District. I will be your host for this evening's program. I'm excited that we're going to share with you tonight thought-provoking and impactful work happening in St. Pete, and specifically here in the Innovation District. This is one of my favorite events of the year, and I hope it is yours as well. To kick off the event, we are pleased to have once again with us a leader in our community who values and encourages innovation. It's reflected in his pillars of progress and the vision for the city. Please welcome Mayor Ken Welsh to kick off this evening's program.
I still am not used to seeing myself in those big photos like that. So that kind of threw me for a moment. How is everyone doing this evening? It's great to see you, and thank you, Allison. It's an honor to join you for the 7th annual State of Science and Innovation. Thanks to Allison and the incredible Innovation District, to all the partners and presenters who are here tonight. I was joking with Allison. I enter these thinking I'm smart, and then on the way out, I feel like an underachiever. Just hearing these innovative projects that will be presented here tonight. I want to recognize some members of our city leadership who are here tonight. Our Vice Chair of the City Council, Lisette Hanowitz, is here. Council Member Gina Driscoll, who you'll hear from in a moment. And I know we have security here, but somehow Ed Montaneri, another great council member. And I love to joke with Ed, but Ed, thank you for your long years of service on the St. Pete City Council. This is always a great experience to learn about innovative projects and initiatives that are highlighted in our community. And they're great examples of the promise of innovation to move our city and our world forward in so many ways, from resilience to economic development to education and more. I was joking with Allison that the State of Science and Innovation occurs every year right before the State of the City. But as we move forward, the two are aligned, whether it's how we deal with climate change or education or economic empowerment. Our embrace of innovation has positioned our city to do great things in the future, and I'm looking forward to that. 2024 obviously was an object lesson on the present challenges of climate change and a reminder of how connected we are with the world around us, and how essential it is to be innovative in the way that we mitigate risk, how we build resiliency, and how we adapt to our new realities here in St. Petersburg. And these challenges have tested us, but they've also reinforced an important truth, that solutions to our greatest obstacles lie in the power of partnership, science, data, and innovation. In response to these challenges, we've seen technology and community collaboration come together to provide real-time solutions, whether through advances in storm modeling, improved infrastructure resilience, and science and data-based efforts to rebuild stronger and smarter. Ward, we were just talking about that. We can rebuild, but we have to do so in a way that makes us stronger for this next storm that we know will come. Looking forward, our challenge is to ensure this innovation serves everyone in St. Petersburg, whether it's providing equitable access to technology, and we just got a great grant. A lot of folks in this room were part of that. Thank you for your leadership, Gina, and everyone who was involved with that. I think it's $6.9 million for digital equity. That's a big deal. Y'all can applaud that going forward. And whether it's fostering STEM education for our youth or starting or supporting startups that drive sustainable solutions, we must ensure that the future we're building is inclusive and just, and that is St. Pete's DNA. So I want to thank everyone who's here tonight. Thank you for your DNA of innovation, of asking how we can overcome challenges, of asking why not, and I look forward to all the presentations tonight. Thanks to your passion, your creativity, and your commitment to make St. Petersburg a city of innovation, our future is very bright. We are St. Pete. God bless y'all. Thank you, Mike.
Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital is one of the founding organizations of the Innovation District. We are grateful for their amazing vision and ongoing leadership. And we're also incredibly thankful for their willingness to host this evening's event. I'd like to invite Janine Rabin to the stage to welcome everybody from Johns Hopkins.
Thank you, Allison. And Mayor, I am so glad I did not get a big picture on the screen, so I understand. I've been in those shoes before. It's so nice to have you here today. My name is Janine Rabin, and I serve as Executive Vice President of our Foundation and Community Health Divisions here at Johns Hopkins All Children's. And I'm a proud board member for the Innovation District. We're so honored to host the State of Science tonight and welcome you, city and business leaders, in our building. My colleagues, Dave Bilardello, who's our Chief of Staff and Government Relations Vice President, is in the back there, and Lisa DeBerry, our Associate Dean of Academic Administration, who's in the front here, we together welcome you to the Research and Education Building. For those of you who might not know Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, I thought I would just give you a little information. We are the number one children's hospital, pediatric academic children's hospital in the state of Florida, rated by U.S. News and World Report. With this distinction, we see some of the sickest and most vulnerable children in the state and in some disciplines in the whole world. We see some of the sickest kids. We also see our community's kids for things like fevers and broken bones. So we're one of those organizations that see the full spectrum of illness and disease. Our primary hospital, which is right here in St. Petersburg, has 256 beds. It's right across the street. It has an emergency room, a neonatal intensive care unit, cancer brain and heart units, as well as radiation, infusion, and surgery centers. You may have heard that we're building a second hospital in Wesley Chapel. That is true, and that hospital will start as a 56-bed hospital and grow over time. We anticipate that that hospital will open in 2027. These two hospitals will join our 11 outpatient care centers that are spread across 8 counties here in the state of Florida, and we will continue to provide Johns Hopkins All Children's quality care. In addition to the clinical part of our mission, which I just described, we're also very committed to science. In 2011, we joined Johns Hopkins Medicine, and we became dedicated to the academic side of medicine, which is including research and education and training. I just wanted to share a few updates with you on this side of our mission, and I think pretty appropriate for tonight. Our research mission continues to grow and expand here at Johns Hopkins All Children's, and we have over 100 active staff who are dedicated to research and who seek to improve the health of children by providing patients and healthcare professionals with access to innovative research opportunities. Here are some stats. We have 450 open research studies. We have 630 research studies in 2024 alone. 241 peer-reviewed articles that are published in scientific and medical journals in 2024, $7 million in awarded new research grants, $41 million in cumulative extramural research awarded in the last 5 years. I wanted to just, for about 90 more seconds, explain two specific centers that we have launched in the last 10 years. And that includes our Institute for Clinical and Translational Research. It started in 2012, and the ICTR brings together our research and trainees from multiple departments throughout the institution, and they work together on clinical and translational science. We launched several research centers and programs addressing common themes that span our many departments and institutes. The second is our Institute for Fundamental Biomedical Research. That was founded in 2019, and the IFBR uses basic science to discover those core leads in what creates and develops disease. And it helps us do further research, not just to treat the disease, but to prevent the disease. The Center for Metabolic Origins of Disease study common diseases such as obesity, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular complications. Also, we have a Center for RNA Biology that will seek advancement in the study of RNA at the molecular level. So just some brief stats and information on some of the science is happening right here in this building today. If you ever want to come back and take a tour, we're doing amazing things in our labs. We have a simulation center and a biorepository on our second floor. And we're just so proud to have you here with us tonight. So I will step away from the mic, but hope you enjoyed tonight's session, and thanks for being with us. Thank you, Allison.
The Innovation District has also benefited from the support of other elected officials, and particularly one that has been an advocate deeply for our marine science community and our efforts to create impactful spaces to incubate small businesses. That is Councilmember Gina Driscoll, and I invite her to join us on the stage.
Thanks, Allison, and good evening, everyone. It's such a pleasure to join you here tonight. As the City Council member for District 6, which includes our Innovation District, I find myself here a lot, and it's usually just out of pure curiosity to see what's happening here, because there's always something interesting going on when you think about all of the different entities that are working with each other and on their own in the Innovation District. These are folks who are working hard every day to find solutions and develop solutions for some of our critical problems today. They're doing it by air, land, and sea, and even to the moon. Tonight, you're going to hear from six presenters, 6 minutes each, six incredible new innovations that they're working on. I can't wait to hear about it. I can't wait to see how Gary Mitchum does everything that he does in 6 minutes, because I've heard him speak several times, and this is going to be, that's the main reason I showed up, to be honest. So we'll see how that goes, but really, I'm looking forward to hearing that and so much more. And so now I invite you to sit back and relax, enjoy the state of science, geek out with me, and let's learn about what's happening in the future right here in St. Pete.
So many of our elected officials who joined us have been recognized, but I just want to thank them again for all of their council members' support, city staff, all of the folks who have made these days and this event possible. The Innovation District's mission is to grow our community. It was created almost 9 years ago, if you can believe that. And its mission is to create and grow careers, businesses, and research. We focus particularly on science and technology and align ourselves with the city and the county's target industries. We focus our work in three areas, and I bring this up because people often tell me you act schizophrenic sometimes, and it's because we're dealing with places, we're dealing with economics, and we're dealing with networking, creating the places and the spaces so that people can come together, creating the draw of incubators, accelerators, interesting companies coming to our community, and then finally networking them all together. Events like today, events like our working groups, our grant pursuits, where we bring disparate groups together, all of that is important to make the Innovation District successful. It also cannot happen without the wonderful leadership of our board members. And I know a number of them are here in the room. If you would stand, I know that Janine Janine had to run to another event, but I saw Tom here. Tom Frazier's in the back from USF College of Marine Science, Jeff Baker from Duke Energy, Julie Rocco from Foundation for Healthy St. Pete, Brian Caper from the City of St. Pete, Jason Mathis from the St. Pete Downtown Partnership, and many more. As you can see, we have a wonderful group that helps kind of keep me in line, make sure that I'm doing what we said we were going to do, and also kind of propel everything together. So a little bit about the program tonight. Gina did an amazing job kind of setting it up for you. If you've been here before, you know it's kind of a fun and different type format. It's going to be 6 speakers, 6 minutes each. And I love to say to people, even if some of the topics you don't initially think you're interested in, I promise you those will probably be the topics you're talking about after you leave the room, because it's such a fun way to see a little bit. So these presentations are going to be very fast and brief. They'll share the incredible work they're doing locally. Many of this work also has national and international implications. I will mention for our folks in the room in particular, after we finish the presentations, we're going to go across the hall for a little reception. And the speakers are going to make themselves available for you all to have chats. It's an opportunity for you to ask questions, to offer your thoughts, commend them on a good job well done, because this format is a little different for them as well. And so that will happen at the end of the session. The speakers today come from throughout the Innovation District. You're going to hear topics starting with coastal flooding and our innovations in healthcare. Then we're going to pivot and delve into the world of data here on Earth and in outer space. We're actually going to talk through a remarkable set of stories and journeys that people have taken and are expanding throughout the future. And I always like to commend the ones that have come before. These speakers are joining a remarkable list of alumni. We've had over the 7 years, 42 presentations by 39 speakers. And they've been from the organizations you're going to hear from today, as well as organizations like Digital Twin Marine, Sail Drone, Pointer Institute, the DALI, Florida Institute of Oceanography, and many more. So I've spoken enough. Now's to the fun part. We're going to start this evening's program. Our first speaker is Dr. Gary Mitchum. We're going to start this evening with a topic that's top of mind for all of us, flooding. 2024 brought some of the worst storms that we've seen in decades. And along with these storms, flooding in places we didn't expect, or maybe some of us didn't expect. We have a unique asset in the Innovation District that's focused on this issue. It's the Florida Flood Hub for Applied Research and Innovation. It was established by the state and based at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science. The Flood Hub bridges the gap between scientists, policymakers, practitioners, and the public to help communities mitigate and adapt to flooding risks. This evening's speaker is part of this unique group. Dr. Gary Mitchum has been a faculty member at the College of Marine Science since 1996. And prior to coming to USF, he was a faculty member in the Department of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii, where he is also the director of the University of Hawaii Sea Level Center. Gary's research focuses on the use of satellite in situ data to study sea level variations and climate change. So with that, I will pass the over to Gary.
Thank you, Allison. So I've never given a talk on the clock like this before. I'm a little intimidated because growing up in South Carolina, talking faster isn't an option. So, sorry. This first slide I was going to tell you a bit. Fortunately, Allison saved me a few seconds by telling us about the Flood Hub already. The Flood Hub has a wide variety of tasks presented to it, covering flooding risk of all sorts and providing data, models, and projections for the future for planning. You know, how do we increase that? What do we need to do to increase our resilience to flooding risk? I'm going to focus today on the ocean impact on flooding. And I'll mention at the very end some of the other things that we're working on. But the ocean's impact, thank you. The ocean's impact on flooding comes up from a variety of different ways. Why does it happen? So let's start with that, if we could go on forward. Thank you. This set of curves that we're looking at here is very simple. It's from 1850, the annual global mean temperature. So when you go from the cooler colors, the bluer colors on the bottom, up to the warmer colors at the top. That's a roughly 1 degree or more increase in global mean temperature. And you see the changes from the winter to the summer. When you hear people talk about, is global warming really happening? I think it's pretty clear here. The second thing that's very clear about this is that we know why it's happening. Our models, the physical models that we use, the climate models that we use, can reproduce exactly this warming if we put in the greenhouse gas emissions. So we know it's an emission problem, and we know the warming. And I was talking to the mayor earlier. If he can tell me what future human behavior is going to be and what the emission forecast is going to be, then I can tell him what the warming is going to be. But that's the hard part of the problem, of course, is what are we going to do with emissions? But the Earth is warming, and so what does that mean for flooding? Three things I'm going to talk about here. The increase in sea level, you see sea level average, sea level rise, you'll hear it called. The high tide flooding problem, I'll mention that as well, because sea level rise impacts that. These are the what some people sometimes call nuisance flooding. I don't like that phrase. I call it high tide flooding, because nuisance makes it sound as though it's not really that big a deal. Don't worry about it. It is a big deal, and there's serious impacts on economics of this low-intensity flooding. And you can ask Cloud Tankersley about that when he's trying to fix all the potholes that pop up all the time. That's due to the high tide flooding. We'll also talk a little bit about storm surge. Okay, so if we could go on to the sea level rise. Oh, see, I'm already behind time. I'm trying to make a point here for you. What I did here was, over the 20th century, if we look at the tide gauge record, the global tide gauge records, we find that sea level increased by 1.5 to 2 inches every 25 years. In the first 25 years of this century, we have satellite measurements that agree with the tide gauge measurements, by the way. And in that 25 years, we've increased by double that, 3 to 4 inches. In the coming 25 years, based on the climate models, which do agree in the past up to this point, it's increased to 6 to 8 inches. So in other words, the sea level rise is not just increasing, it's doubling the rate of increase every 25 years. Okay, so project that out for 50 to 100 years. And that's the problem we're facing. So it looks like in the 20th century, we had a couple of inches in 25 years. Who cares? Well, when it's doubling every 25 years, this is the reason why we're having serious consequences. Go ahead. This is a little bit complicated figure. It's from a paper I co-authored a few years ago. And St. Petersburg happened to be one of the stations that we used as an example. All of you are familiar. If you're living in St. Pete, I think you'll probably all be familiar with spring tides. You know, so twice a month, the tides are higher amplitude than normal, spring tides and neap tides. A lot of people don't realize, though, that these normal lunar cycles, we also increase the height of the tides twice per year. So that's why we have what we sometimes call the spring and fall flooding seasons, because it happens twice per year as well. It's bigger than usual, and we get more of these high tide flooding events. Something not many people are aware of necessarily is that there's also an 18.6-year, almost a 20-year cycle, which is actually larger than the annual cycle. And the frightening thing is, for these low-intensity events, is that right now we're at a peak of that 18.6-year cycle. So we have been seeing over the past few years more of these events, right? That cycle is now going down, and it's going down at about the rate that sea level rise is going up. So these number of events is staying flat at about 6 per year, how we defined an event, okay? Then, though, in the beginning of the next decade, these two come back. High tide is going up faster, sea level rise is going up faster, and the number of events is projected to increase by a factor of 10, from 60 to 6 to almost 70, okay? That's what we're worried about, because we're talking about every high tide being a low-level flooding event. So that's we're very concerned, and we're working on this at the Flood Hub. We're working on an update to this analysis right now as you speak. And considering the storm surge, go ahead. This is a figure that Ben Curtin at the University of Miami gave me. He also sits on our Flood Hub working group. And hurricanes, you hear lots of times, they're getting more frequent and stronger. What this data says and the models say, these are model projections for what we expect over the later part of this century. The total number of storms actually stays about the same or goes down slightly. The thing that's bothersome, though, is that worrisome, is that the intensity of the storms has increased slightly. One thing I want to make sure we tell people, though, is that this does not mean that every storm is now going to be a Cat 5 storm. It's not that. It means that a storm that would have been a mid-level 1 Cat 1 might be a higher level Cat 1 or Cat 2. A Cat 4 will be, maybe be a Cat 5. It's just shifted that a little bit, right? But still, we do expect somewhat higher numbers of storms. Okay, so that's something that we need to take into account as we increase the resilience, but we don't need to run scared. Okay, we can handle this problem. We just need to know what we're facing. That's what I'm saying. A lot of you may remember the flooding of the Vinoy Garage. This was an afternoon thunderstorm. Okay, it was a rain event. It was not storm surge. It was not sea level rise. And that's another factor. When I said the flood hub is attacking flooding risk from a variety of different areas, one of them is intense rainfall. How is this related to global warming? It's very simple. 19th century physics, warmer air holds more water. So when you dump it, it's like taking a bigger pail and dumping it on the ground. Okay, so, and the problem is that our, as the mayor knows very well, our pipes were built before this intensity in the rainfall events increased. It's an infrastructure problem that's going to be very difficult to address. The other aspect is groundwater. How high is the water table? Water has nowhere to soak in. It has to go into your driveway or yard, right? And the final thing is, we've referred to the stormwater system, the water conveyance system, as Tom taught me to call it. How do we do the infrastructure to manage these increased flooding risk? Thank you.
As you can see, it's tough to boil down this incredible body of work into 6 minutes, but I think Gary did an amazing job to give you a flavor of the details of what they're working on. Now, we've heard just one way that innovative thinking is having a direct impact on our life. Now I want to talk about another one. If you've ever been a patient in a hospital, or for some of you who work at a hospital, you know that one thing that can be incredibly complicated is when you must move a patient in a bed. Our second speaker of the evening, Sharon Mulrooney, is going to share a game-changing technology is solving this critical issue. Shannon joined the Orlando Health 15 years ago as a medical oncology graduate nurse at Orlando Health Center Institute after obtaining her BSN from the University of Delaware. Go Blue Hens. What all these Blue Hens that now live in this area. In 2012, Shannon transferred to the Dr. P. Phillips Hospital and advanced to a variety of roles, assistant nurse manager, and then to nursing operations manager of neuro-oncology unit, the outpatient infusion center, and vascular access team. In 2021, she became the nursing operations manager over the medical telemetry unit and the centralized telemetry department at Orlando Health Bayfront Hospital. In 2023, she received the Excellence in Nursing Leadership Award. Shannon takes great pride in her ability to provide personal and professional relationships with peers and her teams that she leads, and we're really thrilled to have her come present this amazing product, Hercules Bed, that's been a game changer for her and her colleagues. Please welcome Shannon.
Good evening, everyone. As Allison mentioned, I'm Shannon Mulrooney, and I'm a nursing operations manager at Orlando Health Bayfront Hospital. I'm excited to be here to introduce Hercules, an innovative equipment system that we implemented in our hospital as of last month. Hercules is an automated repositioning system that allows our hospital staff to reposition patients at the touch of a button. Frequently, repositioning patients is vital for maintaining healthy circulation and preventing pressure injuries. This task has traditionally required multiple staff members and is notorious for leading to physical strain and even injury. With the help of Hercules, a single staff member can reposition patients up to 750 pounds in 15 seconds. This breakthrough not only increases safety and efficiency for our staff, but also significantly enhances the overall patient experience. Now let's take a few minutes to learn more about why and Hercules was created and to see it in action.
Hey, do you have a few minutes to give me a hand?
Yeah, I'll be right there.
Sorry.
Boosting patients up in bed like this is about to be a thing of the past. Let's go see how.
It started with wanting to completely eliminate boosting injuries occurring with bedside nurses.
I lift patients about 10 times during a normal shift. Each time it takes 5 to 10 minutes and I have to go find somebody to help me. So no, not exactly what I went to school for.
So we began to think creatively. Starting with the inspiration from an automated pool cover, we thought, what if the sheet itself could boost the patient? With each new concept, we would solicit feedback from nurses in the field who either quit the profession or are on their way out because of the toll it was taking on their bodies. It needed to be small but powerful. Every patient is unique, so the device had to cover a wide range of situations while keeping the patient safe and comfortable. It needed to be universal because there are so many different types of beds on the market. Our device had to be a perfect fit for all bed models. And lastly, it needed to be extremely reliable, easy to clean and maintain, so we designed it with precision engineering discipline. And what we ended up with is a product that would change the nursing industry forever. It's called the Hercules Patient Repositioner.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Let me make you comfortable.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
How's that?
Much better. Thank you.
By simply pressing a button, you can do what normally takes 5 to 10 minutes in less than 10 seconds without any physical effort. The Hercules Patient Repositioner only has 3 components that work together to do this. The drive unit, which is the brains and muscles of the system, the simple replacement of the mattress cover to keep the sheet aligned, and a special sheet that is twice as long as a normal sheet, which allows for 10 to 12 patient repositionings.
The results speak for themselves. After implementing Hercules in hundreds of hospitals, every facility has experienced 100% elimination of boosting injuries, a significant reduction in caregiver turnover, over a 50% reduction in infection exposure because less people are required in the patient's room, and a decrease in hospital-acquired pressure injuries. And yeah, we're pretty proud of those results. Typical bedside nurses spend over an hour of their shift boosting patients, but now that can be done in a total of 2 minutes. Less time boosting means better patient care, quicker response times, and healthier nurses with improved morale.
So now we're doing something about nursing burnout. Our goal always with this product was to make life safer and easier for nurses and patients. And Hercules is accomplishing that.
Pretty cool, huh? All right, so if you're not directly involved in repositioning patients like our team members are, Hercules might seem like a simple piece of technology compared to all of the other advanced tools and devices we use in the hospital. But as someone who's been a nurse for 15 years and have led nursing teams for 7 years, I can confidently say that having access to this device to simplify such an essential task is truly a game changer for everyone involved. Let's take a closer look at how Hercules impacts safety. Research shows that back injuries and muscle strains, which are common during patient repositioning, make up a 52% of healthcare worker injuries. What's surprising is that that rate is actually higher than the injury rates in high-risk industries like construction and manufacturing. As you can imagine, those injuries can be costly for hospitals, averaging around $24,000 per incident. So while Hercules improves safety for our clinical teams, it also proves to be a cost-effective solution for healthcare organizations. The estimated return on investment for hospitals with Hercules is $200,000 in the first year alone, and a potential savings of over $2 million in the next decade. Following the positive reception of the initial pilot program for Hercules at two of our Central Florida hospital locations in 2024, we've expanded its implementation to all of our Central Florida hospitals and, of course, to Orlando Health Bayfront, our historic 480-bed Level 2 trauma center located just around the corner. This expansion is a significant milestone for us. Orlando Health is proud to be the first healthcare system in Florida to fully integrate Hercules into our care delivery model, setting a new standard for safety and quality care across the state. At Orlando Health, we're dedicated to two core priorities: creating the best workplace for our team members and providing exceptional care to the communities we serve. Introducing innovative solutions like the Hercules system is a clear reflection of that dedication. Thank you guys for your time and for giving me the opportunity to share how Hercules is making a meaningful impact at Orlando Health Bayfront. Thank you.
So now we're going to move from bedside in healthcare to the human body, or specifically an innovative way to study diseases. Our next speaker, Dr. Martin Trapecar? is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. As a trained immunologist and bioengineer, he's using innovative human-on-chip technologies to better understand how fundamental disruption in tissue-tissue and immune crosstalk leads to early emergence of autoimmune and neurodivergent disorders, such as inflammatory bowel disease, autoimmune disease of the liver, and Parkinson's disease. These remain some of the biggest challenges of our time. Martin has a PhD in biomedical engineering from the University of Maribor, Slovenia, and postdoctoral work with Gladstone Institute, UCSF, California, and MIT. Please welcome Martin.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the generous introduction and the wonderful opportunity for me to share our work with you today. Unfortunately, I will have to start on a little bit on some bad news, but I'll promise I'll try to wrap up on some good spirits and some good news. I don't know if you know, but 90% of all drugs in development never reach the patient. They never reach the patient for a number of reasons, but mainly due to lack of efficacy. They simply don't work, either to safety concerns, they have unpredictable side effects, and to other poor properties. It takes about $1 billion to develop a drug, so it's very costly, and it takes anywhere from 10 to 15 years to get it into the market from when we originally conceived the drug. So we can all agree there is some room for improvement, and it's worth to ask how do we actually study diseases, and does this play a role in this high failure rate in drug discovery? So if I gravely oversimplify but try to capture our drug discovery processes, we either have cells or tissues available to study diseases, like from patient biopsies or growing cells in a dish, or on the other hand, we have animals who are not humans, and they're also very complicated. And essentially, this whole middle ground is empty. We don't have anything that resembles human biology, but would also allow us to scale the complexity of the system. One technology that's being at the forefront in the past 10 years is something we call humans on a chip. Another word for it is microphysiological systems. Those are essentially tiny devices that allow us to culture or grow a number of human tissues, all connected fluidically as if they would be in our own body, and hence serve as a model or surrogate model for human biology. So the mission in our laboratory is to try and replicate multi-organ human physiology. We do that to understand how a disruption in inter-organ communication leads to disease, and also how it helps us maintain our healthy self, and to develop new therapeutic strategies to treat autoimmune, metabolic, and neuronal disorders. So we aim to do that by developing new multi-organ microphysiological systems, so new tools that allow us to culture different human cells under fluidic communication. We're also developing new stem cell and 3D bioprinting technologies, because what we put in those devices is just as important as, you know, the devices themselves. And then lastly, use different computational tools that allow us to really make sense of all the data that we're collecting from our disease models and our approaches. So one of the latest technologies, or the latest inventions we've developed in the lab, is what we call an AnthroHive. It's essentially a fluidic platform that allows us to grow and operate at the same time nine individual microphysiological systems. They can be perfused at different rates with fluidics that mimic human blood. They also allow us to control those remotely Bluetooth. So in case when the anthrohive sits in an incubator somewhere far away from the bench. Central to the anthrohive are the individual microphysiological systems that are seated within. Those are designed to house a number of different human tissues. I included some pictures of the things that we grow in the lab, for example, human intestine. We grow also the human liver. I should say representative models of a human liver, not the actual entire human liver. Pancreatic islets, who are important to study insulin, for example, release in different disease scenarios. We have a lot of emphasis on neuronal research, so we grow neurons and human brain constructs. We 3D powerprint muscle, for example. Here's a picture of printed skeletal muscle. That is a very metabolically active organ. And adipose tissue, all the green that you see are essentially lipids that help the adipocytes grow. So we're fattening the fat, so to speak. So the general approach in the lab is when we design a study, we try to identify human donors from whom we can collect different tissues, all coming from the same person. When the tissue comes into the lab, we deconstruct it. We then in-depthly study them to know exactly what kind of state they came in. We then reconstruct the patient or the donor at different levels of complexity. We can perturb then this system and use advanced systems biology tools to kind of understand what the connections are between disease pathology or health. And ultimately, we do want to decipher some of the causal relationships that lead to the origins of diseases. I would like to highlight a couple of ongoing big projects in the lab. One of them is us trying to understand how different immune environments in the body communicate when there's pathogen insult or autoimmune diseases in pediatric patients, for example, that's funded by the DoD. A second project is aimed at trying to develop a gut-liver-brain model of a person that we could actually send to space so that we could study deep space exploration and its effect on the human body, but also to study neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease, for example. And then we are supported by the NIH on a couple of projects, but the main one is really trying to replicate a systemic approach to metabolic disease, where we're trying to understand how interneuron communication leads to diabetes, obesity, and premature aging, nonetheless. What we think the premises of this work is, we hope to develop scalable disease models that are actually relevant to human biology, that accounts for the individuality of each of us. We're not the same at all, yet the same in many other aspects. We want to reduce animal experimentation, also be able to create patient avatars, not just AI, but also physical avatars of patients. By that, we want to know more about origins of diseases, find new tools for regenerative medicine, and also synthetic biology and human-machine hybrids. With that, I'd like to introduce you to our very motivated team, and thank you for your attention, and I'm excited to talk to you later, maybe if you want to. Thank you.
Always amazing, all of these conversations. So now we're gonna move from the human body to a discussion of data. And it's all around us. We're inundated by data, and sometimes making sense of it can be really challenging. Our next speaker, Dr. Heather O'Leary, is actually a second time arounder for this data science, though the last time she was with us was during COVID, and so she had to do it virtual, so I'm kind of glad that she's in person this time. And so she's continuing her work in data. If you saw her presentation last time, this is going to even take it further this time. Heather is an assistant professor at the University of South Florida College of Arts and Sciences Department of Anthropology. She champions citizen engagement for sustainable urban development. Her research interests include transnational disparities related to women's rights, water politics, urbanization, and the environment. She was a Warner, Grenn, and Fulbright Fellow in India, where she's traveled and performed research in Hindi for more than a decade. I did not realize this. You speak both Hindi and Urdu. That's amazing. She researches how sustainable development plans in coastal cities can be more inclusive. She received her MA from the University of Chicago and her PhD from the University of Minnesota. Please welcome Heather. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. So today I'm going to be talking to you about Crescendo, a project that's really captured my heart in the last couple of years. And I think it's very important that I'm an anthropologist. One of the most important things that you need to know about anthropology is, no, I do not study dinosaurs. I do not gather treasures from around the world. But instead, I try and understand what it means to be a human across space and across time. The boundaries of being human can be overcome by understanding that we as humans can talk to anyone anywhere about our common experience. We need to immerse ourselves together to really understand and grow mutual understanding. And this sense of learning together is something that's very important. We have four fields of anthropology and a mysterious fifth field. In biological and medical anthropology, we understand how the body and our ancestry really makes us human and how that's different. I'm going to go back a slide. I think I'm the only one who decided to do auto advance at such a big rate, but I'm thrilled by the challenge. In terms of music and understanding data through music and the arts, we can think about biological and medical anthropology's advances in understanding that the same areas of our brain light up with art exposure as in socializing, which addresses our growing loneliness epidemic. Music is something that's hardwired into our bodies through stimulating the high-stepping, intensive muscle chains in our body, and that by playing music and understanding art, it stimulates multiple regions of the brain at once, which increases our neural connections between memory, spatial reasoning, and literacy skills, all things that we hope to stimulate in the children and the scientists of tomorrow. From an archaeological perspective, we understand humans through our past, and we can see millennia of artistic material culture which transmits data to us without even the spreadsheets that we're used to today. So we can think about how we're transmitting data through art and how that's a core part of what it means to be human. We can also think about the linguistic data. Music promotes cognitive and linguistic development. And also, if we think back to the deep human past, we can think about the Bhagavad Gita or even the Old Testament, which set epics to music and sound so that they would be remembered better. Kids engaging with the arts and language like this are better able to score on the crucial Florida markers for advancement in education. We can also think about ethnomusicology as a part of cultural anthropology, studying the humans around us every day. Here in ethnomusicology, we think about the intersection of art and music in social systems, how they bring value, power, and belonging to everyday people, and how negotiating through the arts can help us find a sense of place. These are sites of dynamic engagement that reveal who we are to one another through play. Finally, ta-da, the breakthrough field, the fifth mysterious field of anthropology, which essentially seeks to change the world through bringing these tools of regular anthropology into everyday life. All of these fascinations with what it means to be human, it really tie into my early work in India, where I was learning a lot more about the social systems and structures that we live in here in the United States, in Florida, in St. Pete, through looking at a lens of another culture. And one of the things that was really compelling to me was their deep, rich history of street theater, where no matter who you were, no matter what your education was, you could meet in the town square and through music and dance and performance, get to know and understand some of the cutting edge science. That informed my approach to Crescendo, our big project. So through Crescendo, we communicate research expansively, so beyond the ivory tower, and instead of just sending out journal articles, we try and meet people where they are, in those central marketplaces, those vibrant hubs in the community. We are using sonification, so we can think about this from the complex spreadsheets that NASA uses in order to try and understand how to sonify or understand orally some of the visual clues that we're understanding about our heavens, to some of the simplest methods, like the temple bell that you might ring when you go into an Indian temple. Listening to that beat and the changes in music are things that our brains can process even if we don't have advanced math skills. So part of Crescendo, the C and the E are being community engaged, regardless of education, language, and ability. Neuroaesthetics is a growing area that Crescendo is moving into. We want to know, how does the human understanding light up in different areas of the brain using different media that describes the same data? We want to know if data-driven art and music can engage more regions for problem-solving and engaging and retaining information. This increases the data literacy opportunities throughout our community, engaging folks who are typically seen as object recipients of data, and rather by allowing them to take arts and music and not only listen and view, but produce some of their own art and their own music, which is not interpretive, but one-to-one mapped in a spreadsheet with data, allows folks to understand and use the tools and skills that they already have to understand something that's quite complex. So let's talk about some of our successes. The first step of Crescendo is always finding and identifying compelling data. My team and I had a NOAA grant and also a Moat Marine Labs State of Florida Protect Our Reefs grant to try and understand how the 2017 to 2019 red tide changed our ability to act as an economy and the social fabric of our communities. We also thought about how the stony coral tissue loss disease impacted our coast, which is something that has been happening to our reefs for over a decade. Instead of just understanding the physical aspects, we also tried to understand the social aspects. We looked at social media posts about these events, and we tracked them over time by all of the counties and the areas in which these marine issues were detected. One of our biggest findings was won a first prize when it was in a high-impact journal, and then it was picked up by Newsweek and policymakers to try and understand and put a price on what happens when a red tide comes to town. But this doesn't capture all of the costs to St. Pete and other areas, because what about the informal economies and the invisibilized environmental labor? This is where we need to begin to experiment together a little bit better. That is, getting into network with all the other humans and all of the other data sets that exist where we are already. So I want you to think about this as a web of insider knowledge. In each discipline and each community, we think about a way of knowing. And when we think about discovery as something that is unidirectional and unilinear on a straight line, first I do the science, then I tell you what I learned. Just like what we learned about the Hercules bed when we were thinking about the feedback loops with the nurses, how do we improve this? How are our models not right? We need to continue to invite everybody in our community into the process of science early on. And that's what Crescendo does. After our student composers worked with our marine and social scientist students to try and understand the spreadsheets of data about the Tampa Bay and the Gulf in our very own backyards, we thought about how we could put that to music. So we had a world premiere concert at the Tampa campus where the student bands performed the spreadsheets that I was staring at every day that would make your eyes water. We also are recruiting student and community artists to interpret the data and make it into a movable gallery that will be shown in five different places in Florida. And we also are working with the USF Augmented Reality Lab. We already have a beta version if you want to see me afterwards, to look and see how augmented reality and folks who can't travel or visit our live stream can use the cell phone that's in their pockets to understand some of our data and our music videos. In addition to this, we prepared EJMLs, or Environmental Justice Mathematics Lessons, and Social Justice Mathematics Lessons, which are due to be practiced by some of the teachers at Lielman Innovation Academy. And we also have sheet music and guides for K-16 level bands, so that if you're a student who's interested in music, you can also start to understand the STEM data that's so important and vital to our everyday community health. We also work through this to create more art support in the community in places that need it. In addition to doing these things that are sort of part of the formal education network, we also think about informal public education, like building exhibits for museums and also free and open to the public workshops in communities. I just presented at the North Community Library for a data literacy project. And also we've worked with Sparks Collective and Creative Clay in downtown St. Pete for supplemental education to build, they put out something on their YouTube channel, What Shines Beneath, which takes the music that we made and corresponds it into contemporary dance and spoken word poetry with ASL. So it's really something that builds into universal design and education. So we also have an eye to the future, and I'm really excited to say that we're hoping to partner more with Innovation District and hopefully some of you. Our dream for some of the next data sets that we sonify and create into a moving gallery is to use their drone to, in real time, take the data of hurricanes that are coming right at us and turn it into sound. So not only will you be able to be delighted by watching the hurricanes spinning by and towards us, you can also listen and understand its intensity through your ears, if not your eyes. So thank you for listening to Crescendo.
I love how that's a great example of the merging. I've always said here in St. Pete, we're so proud of our arts community and then our science and tech, but it really is two intertwined areas. So much of what happens in art is living through science and science and tech can certainly benefit from the use of art. So what an amazing collection. From our discussion about data here on Earth, now we're moving into a presentation about data in the outer space. On February 27th, 2024, Lone Star became the first company in the history to provide a commercial data service en route to the moon. Our next speaker, Chris Stott, led the team that made that happen. Chris was born in the Isle of Man. He obtained a Bachelor's of Arts degree with honors in American Studies, Politics, and Government from the University of Kent, a degree from the University of California, San Diego, where he studied international relations and marine policy at the Scripps Institute, actually. He holds a master's degree in space studies from the International Space University. With over 25 years of experience in space, satellite, and telecommunications, Chris has created an innovative and profitable solution for the global market. He's now leading a venture to pioneer the future of data services from the moon, for the moon, from Earth, or from the Earth for the moon. I'm getting them all mixed up. And he's doing it from St. Pete, from here. So please welcome Chris Stott.
Oh, well, thank you, Allison, Mr. Mayor, councillors, honored guest speakers, everyone. I think I'm one of the last, right? So I'm good. I've got 6 minutes. Okay. So what we do at Lone Star, and we couldn't do this without St. Pete, and we couldn't do it without the community that's here. You have one of the most vibrant entrepreneurial space, cyber, and more anywhere in the world. And that's why we came to St. Pete. Our mission control is just down the street at the Maritime and Defense Hub. But we put data centers on the moon. I know, crazy, right? But we do it for good reasons. Resiliency as a service, disaster recovery, continuity of operations, continuity of government. We look after the state of Florida, one of our first customers who flew with us on our first data center mission earlier this year, back in February, as Allison mentioned. Our next one goes up at the end of this February, with six different governments, AI on board, delay-tolerant networks, and more. But we're making St. Pete the home of this, because it's a natural home. So, rather than me talk about data centers on the moon, how about I actually show you? And with that, if we could see if the video runs.
I'm retired NASA astronaut Nicole Stott, and together, we are Lone Star.
Thank you.
We live in an age of digital wonder. We are experiencing a digital renaissance. Every day, the human race creates over 2.5 quintillion bytes of new data. That's over 1,000 petabytes of new data more than yesterday. And it's doubling every 2 years. We are truly living in a data-defined world. The data we create drives every aspect of our lives. More, it is the very beating heart of our technological civilization. Yet, while that data is so vital, it is also increasingly fragile. As its value continues to increase, the more at risk it becomes from loss, from theft, from network intrusions to nation-state attacks, from natural disasters to climate change, from human error to ransomware. We are at serious risk of losing the data that literally runs our modern world and is the foundation of our everyday lives. So what if we could do something about this? Well, now we can. Lone Star is working to save all our data by utilizing the largest satellite in our skies, the Moon. A place so ideal for global data storage that if it wasn't there, we'd have to build it. 400,000 kilometers away. No climate change, no atmosphere. 24/7 connectivity, leveraging the latest in delay-tolerant networks, enabling broadband links to every nation on Earth. Even more, by utilizing the Moon's natural environment that provides access to a limitless and sustainable energy supply and to a built-in natural source of cooling, all suited to the task of backing up all of our planet's data. How are we doing this? By building on 60 years of return on investment from development and operations associated with space exploration and Silicon Valley. By building a team drawn from the very best of the data center and satellite industries. And more, by working with the best in class of providers to launch a whole new industry, a whole new market solution in global data storage, creating a revolutionary solution to a global data problem. Lone Star will operate on, above, and beneath the surface of the Moon. Our first mission launched with Intuitive Machines and SpaceX in February 2024, and we successfully tested from the Moon. And our next mission is ready to fly on Intuitive Machines' second flight to the Moon in quarter one, 2025. Followed by a series of purpose-designed, multi-petabyte-level data storage orbiters planned to operate in lunar orbit by 2026. And with the future goal of building and deploying exabyte and then yettabyte-level facilities in lava tubes deep in the Moon itself. Our goal is global backup, global refresh, global restore. All from the Moon, all safe, secure, accessible, and sovereign. Lone Star, saving Earth's data one byte at a time.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, that first mission went really well. Thank you. And it's our goal to make St. Petersburg the home of this new global industry. I mean, thank you, because it's an amazing city, sir. It really is. Thank all of you. I mean, goodness. So, when you look at the Moon tonight, look down at the southern tip. And that's where the first mission went. Second one is going up to Shackleton Crater, February 26th. And then last night, two other commercial missions took off as well. One from Firefly and one from iSpace. The world is changing. It's the third decade of the 21st century. You've heard amazing speakers who are doing amazing things, thanks to this amazing city and the amazing team of people. And Alison, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, do you have chills? It's like all of these amazing work that's happening, practical, very tactical, you know, helping people in our community, all the way through the things that are happening in outer space. I am our last speaker of the evening. We're going to pivot slightly, and I'm inviting one of our a special guest to join me here on the stage. So one of the things that the Innovation District has always been tracking is, are we doing what we said we were going to do? And if you saw it when you came in this evening and didn't pick one up, I encourage you to pick up one of our impact reports. Tonight is the release of that. The district was formed in 2016, and over the 8 years, we have strived to help St. Petersburg strengthen industry clusters, expand the number of jobs, increase salaries, and increase grant funding. And we don't work alone. We partner with so many organizations that you heard from today and across the community. In 2020, we published a report about how we were doing. And we knew now 4 years later it was time to do it again. So to accomplish this task, we partnered with Sarah Lindemuth of Mesham to lead the research and Lindsay Petty and her team at Piper to design and publish a report. We just wanted tonight to give you a quick taste of what the report is all about. We're going to hold an event later in the year during one of our morning sparks to deep dive a little bit more in what this means. But I asked Sarah to, in the face of data science, to quickly tell us a little bit about the impact report. Please welcome Sarah Mesham.
Well, thank you very much. I see a number of people flipping through, so I'm glad that you're taking a peruse through the impact report. Just want to give you a little bit of a taste, as Allison said, of the work that we've had over the past 6 months or so in developing this report. And first off, to give some context, innovation districts are used to drive economic prosperity. That's kind of, in a nutshell, what they're in existence to do. They fill in gaps that prior industrial models left behind. Photographed here is one of the examples of the prior models predating the innovation district. So around the 50s, there was a push for research parks. And these were sprawling, often single-purpose entities that were accessible only by personal car in suburban areas. And over the decades, it took quite a bit of time to identify some of the challenges related to this particular model. One, communication gaps. Two, duplicate efforts occurring due to the work really literally occurring in silos. Transportation accessibility limitations, and then access to fresh talent, among other challenges. So pictured here is Stanford Research Park. It's recognized as the first industrial research park, and that stemmed from a collaboration between Stanford University and the city of Palo Alto. And then in the early 2000s, the concept of the innovation district was really coined. And hallmarks of innovation districts are what you see on the slide here, coalescing anchor institutions. So they're the major employers within the innovation district footprint. Two was facilitating mixed-use spaces. So this is where knowledge transfer happens, where networking happens, partnerships, connections, and collisions. And when I say collisions, think of the difference of working from home versus working in a collaborative setting. In the collaborative setting, you can overhear someone talking about a challenge, talking about an issue or a roadblock that they're running into, and you might just peek around the corner and have a solution for them just like that. So those are the types of collisions that we're talking about that the Innovation District really facilitates, positive collisions. Further, the repurposing of vacated structures, and we've seen that with the Innovation District and the Hub. At the bottom, it says a mechanism for experimentation. This is kind of an interesting byproduct of what innovation districts can do for a community. And it's really giving large institutions a place and a safe space to test, trial and error, try things out. A lot of big organizations, that's a challenge for them. They don't, it's not a safe space to really experiment and try things out, or it takes an extended period of time in order to do that. With the Innovation District, there's that mechanism in order to do. They have significant local relevance, but also play a role in bolstering the national image of our little town of St. Pete. And it's supporting recruitment from the individual as well as the corporate level. Pictured here, an aerial of the Innovation District, and granted there's about a 70-75 year gap between the prior photo and this photo, but you can see it's visually apparent the opportunities that are afforded to an organization finding themselves within this type of setting. Now, about the impact reports, any new model comes with skepticism. So the concept of fostering zones that include research labs, that include universities, collaborative spaces, public entities, private corporations, investors, nonprofits, that makes sense on paper. But what is the actual impact? What is the proof of concept in action? And that's what an impact report can do. So you see featured on the screen two examples of prior impact reports, and each had kind of a different intent. In 2020, the idea was to introduce the area to the concept of innovation district to kind of define it. It was new to us. So introduce the anchor institutions and introduce opportunities for the community to engage with the Innovation District. And an interesting byproduct of that report were the requests for, we would like to hear some of the stories. We want to hear what's actually happening within those institutions that are producing the impressive numbers. So 2021, then we published the second piece that you see there, which was more story-driven. And it also helped to grant the public access to some of the things that were happening within the Innovation District. So why is this all important? The current report, we took an opportunity to highlight both stats and stories in this edition. And we wanted to, as Dr. O'Leary mentioned a few minutes ago, really break down some of the walls and the barriers and increase awareness of what's happening, increase accessibility to the stories and to the data. So we took the opportunity to highlight the successes. From an economic standpoint, we took this a step further than we did in the original impact report, and we did an economic contribution analysis. So what does that mean? It means what is the contribution in terms of dollars and in terms of jobs of these various sectors that are making up the pillars of the Innovation District, and the pillars being marine science, life science, entrepreneurship, data and technology, education, and art. So said another way, our contribution analysis was really, if these were absent, this would be the loss to our area, and that echoes out if the organizations were no longer present. Some highlights from the report. The district is a highly concentrated employment hub for the city. It encompasses less than 1% of the square footage of the city, but over 7% of the jobs. The top sectors employing 88% of the 9,000 employees within the district are healthcare, administration, and education. And jobs grew by 6.5% over the past 5 years. And a great sign of the jobs that are occurring here, 62.3% exceed the median income. So why does this all matter? Raising awareness of the investment, collaborations, and innovations that are occurring within the district serves to raise the public profile and broaden recognition of not only the Innovation District, but the institutions that comprise it. An example, what you see on the screen are the grants that were awarded between the years 2020 and 2025. Grant awards tend to follow grant awards. So institutions that are awarded and recognized, they gain momentum and reputation for doing good work with the grant funding, and that makes grant funders more comfortable awarding future awards. So within the 2020 to 2024 timeframe, institutions within the Innovation District earned $125 million in grant awards as the prime, and then $21 million as the sub within that same time frame. It's pretty impressive. So as I wrap up, I want to reiterate the importance of not only the work that's being done, but the factor of sharing the work. It's very easy to get heads down and wrapped up in what we're doing day in and day out, but the beauty of the Innovation District is that it really serves as a mouthpiece and an amplifier of the work that's being done. So don't just hypothesize and make progress, share those hypotheses and the progress and the findings that you're coming to. And it's important from the perspective as well of recruiting individuals, recruiting companies. They all want to be routinely connecting with prospective funders, partners, collaborators, and thought leaders. So presenting the Innovation District as a place that can occur keeps us from moving into the age of the silos of the past.
So if you didn't have a chance, there are two options for getting a copy of the impact report. Pick one up on the lobby as you exit, but first stop at the reception. Or there is an online version. So I thank you. Let's give another round to all the speakers. As you heard, they're doing incredible work. I hope you learned at least one thing you didn't know before you came tonight. The presenters are among many here in the Innovation District doing this remarkable work. We've seen new partnerships as a result of these sharings at the State of Science. We've seen new friendships, new collaborations to test ideas. So I'm optimistic and hopeful that will continue with this evening's presenters and the work that they are doing. I'm going to invite my presenters to start making their way to the reception. What's going to happen is we're going to go across the hall for the folks here in the room, complimentary beverage, have a snack, wonderful food by the library restaurant. So if you haven't had the library, you got to try it out. And we're just going to have a chance for our speakers to answer any questions, tell them how they did, give them a little boost. They kind of went out on a limb to be part of this tonight. And I also want to put a plug in. We're a little crazy here in the Innovation District. We put our two big events every year side by side. So we have State of Science tonight, and in early February, we have the St. Pete Science Festival. Last year, we had 13,000 kids, parents, and grandparents come and see over 60 exhibitors teaching kids about all the stuff you just heard about tonight and even more, and we need volunteers. So if you're willing to come help out, be a part of it, we would love it. If for some reason that doesn't work for you, but you want to come just see the exhibits, please do. And we offer this on February 8th in conjunction with Florida Fish and Wildlife's Marine Quest. And that is also an amazing event. It's all along the USF St. Petersburg campus, Pointer Park, and FWC, which is right there. So please join us. Thank you, finally, to everybody who made this possible. Our host, Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, the board. I got to give kudos to my partner in crime, Lauren Bell, who's up there hiding in the corner. I also have to give kudos to our wonderful volunteers and team members. So we have Andrew, Tamir, Amber's up there is one of our team members, and also Terry just took the speakers to the other room, and I couldn't have done it with their help either. We're a small but mighty two-person team with these folks. They make things possible. So with that, we are done for the evening. It's in the bag. Head over to the reception.